Yeah, so what I'm going to talk about today is superfluo dark matter, but basically a set of models that reduce to things that are similar to superfluo dark matter and why they are inconsistent with Milky Way dynamics. And so this is based on these two papers from last year and from 2 weeks ago with these authors. So this is Mariangela Di Sante and Matt Mascella from Princeton and Davut Mezgin from Tel Aviv University. Let's start with the best things from the 80s, right? So the 80s were great. Queen, Back to the Future, and you know, definitely Madonna. And then also rotation curves, right? So in June of 1980, Vera Rubin and collaborators published the first paper that told us that dark matter exists on galaxy scales as well as cluster scales. And so this was really the first definitive evidence that dark matter exists at the scale of galaxies, and we had the first evidence for flatness of rotation curves in their outer regions. And so if we were physicists back then, we would have tried to solve this in one of two ways. We would have looked at the Poisson equation and either tried to modify the right-hand side to invoke some additional amount of energy or mass, and that would have been the standard dark matter solution, or we would have gone to the left-hand side and tried to change the equations of motion themselves and invoke some kind of modification, IR modification to gravity. Or if we were really progressive thinkers, we might think of some kind of mix of these two things. And amazingly, at least on galactic scales, it's still not clear cut today which is the right direction to go out of these three options. And so the outline of my talk is as follows. I'm going to spend 5 or 10 minutes just discussing what the missing mass or the dark matter problem is on galactic scales in a modern context in 2019. I'm going to talk about the features of various different classes of solutions. I'm going to give a little primer on what superfluid dark matter is and explain to you why it's a test model for various other classes of theories. I'm going to discuss our framework for testing these theories and show you some results and conclusions. So that's the outline of the book. So let's spend a few minutes discussing what we know about the missing mass problem on galactic scales in a modern context. So of course, we know that rotation curves are flat. We've known that since the 80s. We know that there are issues with small scale observables, and so there's the famous missing satellite problem, which recently people claim might have already been solved. There's the too big to fail problem. There's the core versus cusp problem. I'm not going to go into these. These are issues with substructure smaller than galactic scales. And then there is a bunch of measurements, a bunch of hints that tell us that dark matter correlates with baryon. So let's just dive into those a little bit more deeply. And everything I'm going to say is observational. Right? So just observational facts about the dark matter properties on galactic scales. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is something known as the diversity problem. And this was kind of reborn recently in the context of self-interacting dark matter. And these authors had, Kamada and Kaplan had in 2016 published this paper where they showed that for a wide variety of galaxies, what you find is that galaxies that are housed in similar-sized dark matter halos have very different rotation curves. So, for example, if you look at these two galaxies, this one and this one, you see that they both have approximately the same velocities on their outer regions. That's a proxy for the halo mass. So they have similar halo masses. But this galaxy has a very sharp turn-on and flattens out at around 2 or 3 kpc, whereas this galaxy turns on much slower and flattens out at around 15 or 20 kpc. And naively, there's no reason to expect that to happen from standard CDM. So the authors of this paper solved the problem using self-interacting dark matter. I'll go into that solution in a second. But just to show the same information in a little bit of a different way, what you can do is you can plot the rotation curves of many different galaxies that all have approximately the same external velocity. So all of these galaxies live in similar-sized dark matter halos. And they've been color-coded according to their surface brightness. So red, low surface brightness, to blue, high surface brightness. And you can see this clear correlation that low surface brightness galaxies are more cored, they turn on more slowly, and high surface brightness galaxies, the blue ones, turn on faster and have a more cuspy kind of profile. And amazingly, if these galaxies had been plotted not just as a function of radius, but normalized to the scale radius of baryons in the galaxies, they would have all been self-similar. So somehow, galaxies know to turn on in a way that's correlated with the baryons in that galaxy. And importantly, all of these guys have velocities that are very small in their outer regions. So these are extremely dark matter dominated systems. So even in a very dark matter dominated systems, rotation curves know about the baryons in those systems.
Wait, sorry. Like when you say that is dark matter dominated, is that also true for these ones?
From the previous slide?
Well, like some of these galaxies have these very steep rises.
Sure, but I mean, the point is that these are all dwarf galaxies. These are all small galaxies.
Dark matter doesn't give you rotation curves that rise and then flatten.
I mean, in this galaxy at least, even though most of the galaxy is dark matter, the rotation curve is turning on where...
The region is baryon dominated, right?
It's baryon dominated with respect to that galaxy. That's true.
What do you then mean? What, is it?
What I mean is that the rotation curve in galaxies, even like dwarfs, knows about the half-light radius of that galaxy. That's basically the claim.
I mean, what if they're very undominated?
I mean, a surprising thing is, for example, this. You might imagine that the rotation curve turns on and then goes down and flattens out. But it somehow happens that the rotation curve, right, baryons turn off and dark matter turns on exactly in a correlated way, such that it always goes up and then flattens out. And that behavior, for example, is something that you wouldn't naively expect if it was just, you know, baryons are turning things on. I mean, this is the claim, at least in the literature, and it's known as the dark matter baryon conspiracy. It is what it is. I mean, okay. Then another piece of information, which is maybe take this with a grain of salt, is something known as Renzo's rule. I thought I'd just bring it up here. So what you can do is you can take galaxies, and these were galaxies famously analyzed by Renzo Sanchisi in 2003, and you can measure two things. You can measure the rotation curve of the galaxy, right? That's these lines. And then you can take the baryonic profile, solve the Poisson equation, and measure the would-be rotation curve from baryons only. And that's this curve over here. And what you see is this feature in the baryon rotation curve, which closely follows the feature in the measured rotation curve. And again, this is something that's not naively expected just from regular CDM. Yeah? So there's at least a handful of galaxies that look like this. You seem unhappy.
Shouldn't take over your talk.
No, it's fine.
Well, this V, I guess, is, you know, this V is like some circularly averaged V. And if we have these features, then, you know, these features presumably arise when, like, the gas profile is not circular.
I mean, people make that claim. That's true, yeah. What you're saying. But, I mean, at least the Renzo rule is that if you take a large ensemble of galaxies, these features, statistically, you see that there is a correlation. But it's true that it might be just that really these measurements are secretly correlated, which is basically what you're saying.
Like, the places where I see features might be the places where my circular assumption is bad.
But the point is that this line is measured just by measuring where the light is coming from. And this line is measured by, you know, widths of, you know, of atomic lines or something. So it's
and translating that into a circuit.
And translating it, exactly. Yeah. So the claim is that the measurements are uncorrelated, and what you're saying is they might be correlated, and that might be true. Fair enough. Yeah. I agree. I mean, everything I'm saying is, you know, it's facts that might have measurement bias in them and mistakes. All true. Right, then something known as the radial acceleration relation is the following. You can take a bunch of galaxies. For each galaxy, what you can do is you can measure the rotation curve. You can again take, measure the baryons in these galaxies and plot the would-be rotation curve from baryons only. In this case, that's, I think, this curved line, this line. And then for each point where you've measured the rotation curve, what you can do is you can plot the observed acceleration, so just V observed squared divided by the radius, as a function of the baryonic acceleration. So V baryon squared divided by the same radius, and you get a scatter plot that looks like this. And then you can take a bunch of galaxies, and so these authors took about 200 galaxies with many data points, plotted them all on the scatter plot, and find this very tight correlation between the observed acceleration and the baryonic only acceleration. And the claim of these authors is that the scatter is consistent with zero intrinsic scatter. So a very tight correlation and an acceleration scale that appears in the data. So for some reason, galaxies know that they need to start deviating from Newtonian dynamics with baryons only at a typical acceleration of about 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. right? And then finally, the baryonic Tully-Fisher relation, which is the fact that the baryonic mass of galaxies is very tightly correlated with the velocity at the outer regions of those galaxies. And this information is really just the low acceleration information of this plot. So if you go and measure the slope, what you find is that the observed acceleration just scales as the square root of the baryonic acceleration. You just measure this, you see that it's the square root. And then you can, you know, just solve for a point mass and you get the relation that M baryon goes approximately like the fourth power of V final. And so all of these hints can be incorporated by a very simple scaling relation, historically known as the MDAR, the mass discrepancy acceleration relation. And historically that phrase has been used for various different things, but I'm gonna use that phrase just to mean this very simple scaling relation. So there are hints from galaxies that tell us that the acceleration needs to be Newtonian above some acceleration scale, and it needs to go like the square root of that scale times a Newton below that acceleration scale. And this number tends to be the same in all galaxies, and it's about 1.2 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. And this is just, you know, a fact about the pheno of galaxies. Yeah? So how can you build a model that solves these problems, you know, that gives you the MDAR? So, of course, the most standard thing to do is just have CDM with baryonic feedback. And people have recently claimed that even, you know, doing this, you get from how feedback works on galactic scales, you get the acceleration scale that you need. You get the right value. Then another thing you can do is go in the direction of self-interacting dark matter. And Kaplingat and Haibo-Yu have solved these problems by invoking a self-interacting dark matter candidate, which thermalizes below some radius. And when it thermalizes, you get an isothermal profile as opposed to an NFW. And that isothermal profile is exponentially dependent on the total baryonic plus dark matter potential. That exponential dependence gives you the correlations that you need. So these are maybe the more standard kind of ways of doing it within dark matter. Then what you can do is you can go to the totally opposite regime and try and invoke something like modified gravity, MOND, or its relativistic version, Tevis. But then if you give a talk about something like that, people in the audience get upset. And for good reason, because, you know, these things don't do good on anything above galactic scales. And so what you can try and do is build a theory that mimics MOND on galactic scales, but give a different theory, cold dark matter on cluster scales and above. And an example of that is superfluid dark matter. And so, importantly, the standard law for many, many years has been that everything on the left-hand side is excellent at fitting very subtle correlations on galactic scales. Right, so that is the standard picture, that everything here does very well on galaxies. And the summary of this talk is that I'm going to show you that at least with Milky Way observables, that's not really true, and the right-hand side seems to be preferred even on galactic scales. And so that's really the summary of this talk, and I'll show you what I mean in a minute. And so just to give a bit more context, last year, Gianfranco Bertone and Tim Tate came out with this paper which summarized, you know, the various ways to solve the dark matter problem. And so everything in circles now is kind of the right-hand side of the previous plot, and then this and this are kind of the left-hand side of the previous plot. So I hope I've convinced you at least that we should be thinking broadly about the different kinds of solutions. And so how do you go about building a model that does this with a fundamental force? How do you go about building a model that gives you the MDAR on galactic scales? So the first thing you need to do is you need to produce flat rotation curves. And so all of these models are designed to give you a flat rotation curve. And if you think about what that means in terms of the potential of the galaxy, you need a potential that goes like log of r, so that the acceleration goes like 1 over r, so that you get a flat rotation curve. So basically, you need to somehow, you know, do one of the steps along the way here in order to get this to work. And different models do this in different ways, but typically they all reduce to a very simple relation between the observed acceleration and the Newtonian acceleration with some function that just has the right asymptotic values. So this function is known in the literature as the interpolation function. And all it has to do is it has to go like 1 over the square root of its argument at low accelerations and go like unity at high accelerations, and that reproduces the MDAR, right? So you can go about it any way you want, but typically everything reduces to this. And for example, in 2016-17, Stacey McGaugh tried to fit the radial acceleration relation with an example of an interpolation function. This has no fundamental, you know, there's no fundamental theory behind this. It's just an example of something that gives the right asymptotic values. And he was able to fit this with some value of A naught, right? The correct value. But if you think about it, the radial acceleration relation is just an observational measurement of what this acceleration, what this interpolation function is. So instead of plotting A observed as a function of A baryon, what you can plot is A observed divided by A baryon, that's this axis, as a function of A baryon, and you're plotting the observational interpolation function that exists from the Spark data. And so that's what I've plotted for you here. And interestingly, solar acceleration, luckily, happens to live here. So we happen to be living in a place where we're just beginning to be sensitive to deviations from Newtonian dynamics. We're in a place where it looks like, you know, whatever is driving the dark matter enhancement of acceleration, we're sensitive to it. So this is just lucky. And if we take only local measurements around the sun, then we're not really sensitive to this whole function, you know, be it something fundamental or not. We're sensitive to a very small region of it, okay? So if we want to ask if this is a fundamental thing, we can just Taylor expand the function without imposing any, you know, specific interpolation function that has no fundamental reason, but just ask the question, does any set of nu naught, nu one, any Taylor function expansion give you the right result? And so that's really what we're going to do, at least in the first part of this talk. And so the one thing you can do is you can just ask a model independent, when I say model independent, I mean interpolation function independent question, does any kind of force like this fit galactic dynamics? And so I'm going to answer that question in a minute. And then you can go to a specific realization, and an example is either choosing some specific function or superfluid, which has, you know, a very concrete prediction. And so again, we're testing these models exactly where they're supposed to be their best. So let me talk for 5 minutes about superfluid. And again, I know that some people don't really love this model, and it's difficult to UV complete, that's true. But it's just, I mean, I'd like you to think about it as a test case for a model that does what we need, right? It's a test case that with a fundamental force and possibly a UV completion, it fits. It's supposed to fit data on galactic scales and on cluster scales. So let me just talk about this and not go into the details too much. So the idea is that you have a light scalar dark matter particle with mass m in the region of an electron volt. You require that it condenses to a state where the relevant degrees of freedom are phonons. So you require that it condenses to something you call a superfluid. How do you require that? You want the Debreely wavelength of these particles to overlap. And so given a virial velocity and a virial mass of your galaxy, a virial density, you can calculate what that means for a bound on m, and you get that m needs to be approximately less than 2 electron volt. And you can now calculate the critical temperature just by saturating this equation, and the critical temperature turns out to be a few millikelvin in units of, you know, if you do this in natural units. And so interestingly, these are values that are measured on Earth for cold atom systems, for critical temperatures. So that's just an interesting fact. And now you can ask what the virial temperature is on different systems. In galaxies, the virial temperature, you just take the virial velocity and you know, take the mass and turn it into temperature, you get that it's approximately 0.1 millikelvin, so you're condensed in the superfluid state in galaxies. And in clusters, the potential is deeper, so velocities are larger, and temperatures are higher, and you're in your CDM state. So that's the basic idea. And then there is some self-interacting cross-section, and that self-interacting cross-section has to be give you interactions that are fast enough such that things thermalize. And so what happens is that above some radius, things have not thermalized, and you're in your cold dark matter state. This is now in a galaxy. So above some radius, approximately 40 kpc, you're just an NFW profile. That's this black line over here. And below that radius, you're in your superfluid phase. And let me explain you what happens here. So now the magic happens by invoking this fancy Lagrangian. So you invoke this Lagrangian, where phi is the field of the phonon in the superfluid. And if you put this here, you see that you have a kinetic term that goes like the third power of the gradient, right? So this is a very unusual kinetic term. It turns out that in cold atom systems on Earth, people have measured 5 half powers. Three half has not been measured. But really, this three half power is the thing that gives you your log of R, right? So just to make this point clear, if you ever want to get a log of R, what you need is a scalar field, and you need to have a Lagrangian that looks like grad phi q to the third. If you do the equations of motion for that, and just a delta function for your, just a point mass, you get a log of R. I mean, just do the math and you'll see that's what happens. So this is the trick that's giving you a flat rotation curve. And, you know, Justin is calling this superfluid Lagrangian, whatever. It doesn't matter. This is the power that you need to get a flat rotation curve. Okay, so this is like a generic thing of any theory that's ever going to give you a flat rotation curve. And then you impose this Planck-suppressed coupling between your phonons and your baryons, and what you get is an emergent force that looks like Mond. And so you can also solve for the superfluid density. What you find is that below this radius, you get a very chord density. Red here is what an NFW would be like, and black is what the superfluid looks like. And so you get a much more core dark matter profile below 40 kpc, and your acceleration, your measured acceleration, is what you would get from baryons plus dark matter, this superfluid dark matter in the center, which is subdominant, and your phonon emergent force. So, right?
All right. So this phi by itself is some sort of composite thing?
It's probably a composite thing, exactly.
So if I test in the lab,
so yeah,
what
happens is that velocity, you can ask the question, there's some critical velocity above which things are not coherent anymore. And close enough to any object, for example, the sun, that's what happens. So around us, you're actually in the axion phase. So you're in a particle phase on Earth and not in a superfluid phase. So direct detection works and you're not measuring this Lagrangian, but rather...
There's been something else about force exchange of phi, because that's a linear coupling, so maybe... Right.
It's not quite a 1 over R force. Asymptotically, it's a 1 over R force.
Yeah, but at short distance, what is it?
If I put two test masses nearby, does this phi create a force or not?
But this is not the Lagrangian that's relevant here. You're not in a background of superfluid on, you know, in this classroom.
I understand the kinetic term is modified by this superfluid stuff. Does the coupling to baryons also modify?
Oh, I guess yes, it must be.
What is lambda here?
Lambda is some scale which is sub milliEV. It's a parameter of your model, and it turns out to be tiny. I'm not sure about the answer to that question, Maxime. I think it must also be modified. We can look at the UV completion that he has, and I need to think about that.
Have they ever looked at early universe?
I don't think they've looked at early universe. I'm not sure. Yeah.
What about clusters?
They've looked at clusters, and the claim is that it's just like it's an axion-like particle on cluster scales, and so everything works. You get lensing. Okay. And so I mean, maybe this is the force that you would get, right? So you can now solve for the equations of motion, write down what your interpolation function is, you know, there's some enhancement to accelerations, and asymptotically, it looks exactly like what you need, right? So this is your phonon-mediated force. It goes like the grad of your field, and if you do the equations of motion, it's some modified Poisson equation, what you get is a log of R, or, you know, in terms of how it correlates to baryonic acceleration, you get the square root of AB. And you can identify this thing as your A naught. So this thing is really just the value that we know exists in nature. Right, and solar acceleration lives in a region that we can measure. So how do we constrain these models? So basically the result of our paper is gonna be in this slide and the next slide. This is like a cartoon figure of what we've actually done. So what you can do is you can ask the question, you know, does any model like this fit Milky Way measurements? And the way you can answer that question is by plotting the radial velocity, right? That's this data point. So the x-axis here is radial velocity locally, so at the position of the sun. And this is the data point from Gaia. So a data point from 1 year ago, 2 years ago. And on the y-axis, what I've plotted for you here is the sigma z, is the velocity dispersion in the z direction at some position above the disk, close to the sun. So I've chosen 1 kpc. And this is not a cherry-picked value. This is just a random value. Anything else would have been the same. And this is data from SDSS. So this is where data lives, right? Take the baryonic profile of value, which is the question, add an NFW profile of dark matter, and choose its parameters such that you try and get these values, and that's the blue line. So this is the baryonic profile plus dark matter, and you see that you can get both of them simultaneously. And then you can try do it with any Mond-like force, so just take an interpolation function, Taylor expand it, and ask the question, does any Taylor expansion give you this result? And what you see is this red line, which either over-predicts the rotational value or under-predicts sigma z. And the reason is that these Mond-like theories are always enhancing the radial and vertical accelerations on the same footing, right? So if you enhance R, you have to enhance Z. And dark matter doesn't have to do that. And, you know, something that we found in the study, and this is really our main finding, is that Milky Way data informs us that you need to enhance radial acceleration by a factor of a little bit, factor of 2, but you need to basically not touch the vertical acceleration. And that's something that was not known in the literature, and basically any model you ever build needs to be able to do that. And Mond is not able to do that.
So your y-axis is
it's velocity dispersion in the z-direction. It's a proxy for vertical acceleration. You need to solve the Jeans equation to turn that into a z-acceleration.
Like the measure scale height or something to translate from a dispersion to an acceleration?
You need to just solve the Jeans equation, yeah.
Using like a scale height or something, is that what you mean?
I don't know what you mean by using a scale. You can just solve it, you know, anywhere along the z-axis. I'll show you the equation in a minute. I mean, the Jeans equation just, you know, tells you the relation between accelerations and velocity dispersions.
So
you
I
need to know density.
Acceleration profile vertically, and also I can have like any dispersion, like, you know, vertically. So for example, we have like a thin disk and a thick disk that have different dispersions vertically. But that's fine because they have different scale heights. And so my question is to translate.
But you can translate it by just doing measurements. So forget about the model. Just give me a set of vertical dispersions, right? Give me the density everywhere measured, you know, and from that I can bin the data and or fit, you know, fit functions to that data and infer what AZ that solves the Jeans equation is without modeling anything. That's not a model dependent. That's not a, you know, you don't have to know anything about the scale height of the disk to do that.
Okay, but there are populations that have different sigma z.
I agree. So this is for a specific population.
That's right. Okay.
I'll show you the data. Okay. Let me show you. I mean, this is what it looks like, right? This is velocity dispersion data, and I'll show you in a minute the equation of how that's converted into accelerations. Yeah.
Point out in my modified gravity theory, which is not Mond, the vertical acceleration is approximately Newtonian as predicted for the vertical. So the dispersion velocity should agree with that data.
I agree. As we discussed yesterday, I think in your model that would be true.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
The problem with Mond is, as you point out, it amplifies every acceleration. And it's because it's a simple scale, magnitude scale. And it's never been good enough. It doesn't fit the clusters. It certainly doesn't do cosmology. So the problem is that it's used as a football. Dark matter, because it's not working. Okay? So let's perhaps concentrate on the model that does.
I agree. I mean, everything I'm going to say here doesn't. I don't care about Mond. I don't care about any model. I'm just saying the following. There's a new criterion that needs to be satisfied, and that criterion is enhanced radial acceleration, but don't touch vertical. And I'm just checking which models do that. That's all I'm, that's basically my claim.
This is a good approach. It's a fair, because we need empirical data that separates all this stuff out.
Right.
Either it's right or wrong. That's what physics is.
Right. Okay. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so superfluid dark matter now is more predictive. You can now use more data. Okay, so I'm not Taylor expanding anymore. I'm just solving the equations of motion for the superfluid. And I'm using all data, so I'm going to be, so this is just a blow up of R and Z in some slice of the galaxy of the Milky Way. And what I've shown you here is blue predictions for acceleration for CDM, red predictions for acceleration for superfluid dark matter, and black data. Okay, so again, this is not directly data. This is data as inferred by measuring velocity dispersions and velocities, and using the Jeans equation to infer accelerations, right? And so this is data, and you see that the data always points closer to the blue, okay? And I should also make the point that this is for the best fit solutions. I'm gonna do an MCMC analysis in a minute. And so this is all for the best fit solutions of everything, okay? Of dark matter or superfluid and you know the best fit baryonic profile.
What is the state that's in the galaxy? Do you keep coherence of the superfluid state? Because if you have stars in solar systems, this is the superfluid state is disrupted. So why?
It's, I mean, I guess the point is, so Justin has a whole paragraph about this in his paper. I can show it to you.
Paragraph. Wow.
I mean, a whole section, sorry. It's a whole page. And so when you're close to stars, what happens is that your velocities are too large and you lose coherence. That's true.
Yeah, so then why do you recover coherence given that things move?
I think the point is that on large scales, the coupling that I showed you is an effective coupling. So, I mean, you might lose coherence, but still, you know, things are interacting. And so when you move far away enough from the stars, you create these phonons. So even though, is that not answering your question? You're not answering, I mean, you're saying...
Why does that happen? Why
then how can two stars far away from each other, even though there's no condensate here and there's no condensate here, how can they interact? Is that the question?
Because things move, right? So when you, so the point is that as stars move, they interact gravitationally at least with the condensate and then disrupt the phase.
Oh, you're talking about the stars moving within the condensate.
Everything moves, right? You have stuff.
I mean, but the coupling to baryons is tiny, so I don't know if that's an important effect.
Gravitational coupling. So if you calculate, if you have 2 points, and you calculate how much phase difference you could accumulate over the age of the galaxy is a lot. So two places. So one of the things about the superfluid state is phase coherence.
Sure.
Usually when people do experiments in the lab, and I don't know what the superfluid is, but when people do experiments in the lab with PEC and they put them in a time-dependent potential, they disrupt the BC and they lose long range phase coherence. Now,
but can you do that with a gravitational interaction only? I mean,
because the gravitational interaction depends on, I mean, we are locally gravitationally dominated, right?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I don't think Justin discusses that point. He discusses a different point, which has to do with the fact that the virial velocity close to a star grows and takes you out of the coherent phase.
Yeah, but that's,
different, yeah.
Reason, right?
I don't know the answer to that.
These people introduce what's called chameleon screening and other screenings and contrived screenings in order to shield.
Sure, but I don't know that also answers the question. Yeah, that's true. I mean, there's...
It's been going on for a long time.
Anyway, again, I don't want to go too much into the details of this.
Because the reason I'm saying is that, I mean... How can you place a constraint if you don't know what the theory does in AI?
I agree with you. I agree with you. You can think about this as any effective theory that has a, you know... I mean, this is true for any effective theory that gives you a log of R.
I definitely agree with that, because, yeah.
So, I mean, you can take it as that being the point, if you want. But I agree with you. I mean, this theory has lots of problems. Okay, so, yeah, what you get in the end, so just to show you what the data looks like, so this is the rotation curve, blue dark matter, red superfluid. You see that both of them kind of fit the data nicely. And then this is the velocity dispersion in the z-direction, blue dark matter, red superfluid, and you see that the superfluid overpredicts. And again, this is for the best fit, and I'll show you where most of the tension is actually coming from. It's not all of the tension is coming from here, but some of it is. But in principle, you see the picture that I told you from the previous slide. Superfluid can do one, but not the other. It can't simultaneously fit both. If it does the rotation curve well, it overpredicts velocity dispersions in the z-direction. Right. Okay, so in principle, all you need to do is measure A and measure AN, and you're done, right? So in principle, I've told you everything that needs to be said. But, you know, measurements are imperfect. The bearing profile is not perfectly measured. You never measure accelerations, but only velocities and dispersions, and you need to infer accelerations via Jean's equation. And so we've adopted a Bayesian approach, and, you know, given a model, which is going to be either CDM or one of these other models, either superfluid or generic bond-like force, anything that gives a log of R, with some set of parameters, you construct a likelihood function, there's observations and predictions, and you can impose reasonable priors and recover posterior distributions. And that's what we've done. And so the way we model dark matter is with a generalized NFW profile, so just an NFW profile that has additional freedom for the central slope. And for the superfluid or Mond-like force, so for superfluid, just what I told you in previous slides, and for the Mond-like force, just a Taylor expansion. So totally agnostic to what the actual interpolation function is. And then our baryonic model is a double exponential stellar disk, a double exponential gas disk, and a Hernquist stellar bulge. And we perform an MCMC analysis and find best fit parameters. So this is what our baryonic profile looks like. Again, a stellar bulge, a stellar disk, and a gas disk. We only model the thin disk, and we check that the thick disk is actually negligible. So we did a check where we modeled the thick disk as well, and it didn't change any of the results. And these are the measurements that we try and fit to: the local stellar surface density, the local gas surface density, the disk scale radius, stars and gas, the disk scale height for stars and gas, the bulge mass, the rotation curve, and the vertical accelerations. So the rotation curve, just to give you a feel of the data, this is the data recently measured by Gaia 2 years ago, one and a half years ago. And so the small black points are the new data. The gray bands, the gray data is from SDSS, that's old. So really, you see how much the new data helps us. It's much, much better than the velocity curve that we used
what
to have.
How big are the error?
They're tiny. They're within there. They're less than 5%.
Of the nominal velocity.
The error bars are plotted here. You just can't see them.
Yeah. Right,
yeah, over here you can see them, exactly. They grow here. Okay, we actually stop where error bars start to grow. So, yeah. And then the vertical acceleration is inferred from 9,000 K dwarfs, I think this will answer your question, from the SEG subsurvey of SDSS. So this is the data. These are the three populations. This is sigma z. There's also measurements of the density of each of these populations. And so you can plug this into the Jean's equation. You need to assume a negligible tilt term, and you can infer AZ from sigma Z, right? You can invert this equation, but you get an equation that correlates between AZ and sigma Z. Does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah, mostly. I mean, so what's like the volume over which this modeling is being done?
So for this, for the vertical acceleration, it's between 0.3 and 1.5 kpc.
Around us.
Close to us.
And so are you assuming, you know, that the disk is in equilibrium?
Okay, so we assumed that for this analysis, and then we multiplied the error bars by a factor of 2 to check if, you know, because it introduces errors in your result. So we multiplied the errors by a factor of 2 to check if that would have made any difference, and it didn't. But we did assume equilibrium in our analysis. That is a caveat.
This plot, showing sigma as a function of height had these like wiggles in it. It was sort of surprising.
I guess you mean wiggles like this and like this?
Yeah, I guess that's right.
I mean, there must be substructure there. You know, our baryonic profile is smooth and it's just this double exponential. That's probably not perfect. So it's probably coming from something like that. You know, the disk is not really a perfect double exponential. It has arms and whatever. So yeah, that's just our modeling is imperfect.
Mm-hmm. you saw the G's equation, did you assume that the isotropy tensor is isotropic?
Did we assume, what is the isotropy tensor?
Yeah, is it, when you saw a simple solution to the G's equation is to assume that the isotropy coefficient beta is zero.
I don't know what, I mean, you can solve it. We solved it in cylindrical coordinates and assumed that there is cylindrical symmetry. That's the only assumption we made.
We have to assume something about the isotropy of the galaxy.
I mean, I can show you the Jeans equation.
You write down the Jeans equation. There's an additional contribution from isotropy or anisotropy.
I'm not sure what you mean, actually.
So I think he's saying that sigma r and sigma, like, was it sigma theta, sigma r, also, I think he says, enters?
Sigma r, sigma z enters. I don't know if that's what you mean. And that's known as the tilt term, which you can neglect when you're close enough to the disk. And we checked that it's negligible, and it is. So if that's what you mean, then
I think that's what he means.
then we...
It's in Binney and Tremaine, Princeton, a section on the Jeans equation.
Yeah. I'll show you. We can look at Binney and Tremaine afterwards. But we did this carefully.
You did check.
Yes. Okay. And then we ensured self-consistency. So we only use measurements and locations where nonlinear effects from these weird models, which are nonlinear, are negligible. So that's not a problem. And we only use measurements that were not inferred dynamically under the assumption of dark matter. So no, disk measurements or baryonic measurements that were inferred. Everything is just stellar counting, things that have nothing to do with dark matter. So everything is self-consistent. And let me spend 10 minutes just showing you the results. So, so for any Mond-like model, anything that reproduces a Mond-like force, what we did is we just expanded the interpolation function, tried to fit for these two parameters, and asked, does anything fit? And we only fit to local values of the rotation curve, so not the full rotation curve, because we want it to be as agnostic to details as possible. And this is the result. So red blob is the 1 and 2 sigma region of our best fit for these Taylor expansion parameters. And now what you can do is you can compare this to interpolation functions that exist in the literature. For example, the gray here is what Stacey McGaw fitted the radial acceleration to. And so it's this function. And you can ask where that falls in this plane. And it falls here, and we've excluded it at 95% confidence level. Not to say that we've excluded this function. We've excluded this function with this value of A naught. Okay? So, that's the caveat. And then you can ask, there's tension that's coming, and the tension is actually coming when you compare baryonic parameters. So what I'm going to show you here is the correlations in the final results of the scan between the scale radius of the galaxy, the disk mass, and the bulge mass of the galaxy. Stellar bulge, stellar disk, and scale radius. So let's just concentrate on this plot here. So this is scale radius as a function of disk mass. And red is our Mond-like scan. Blue is dark matter. And you see they both follow this banana shape. The reason is that they're both trying to fit the stellar surface density. Okay, and so this equation is being followed. And that's the black line here. That's not surprising. Okay, then you can look at M bulge as a function of M disk. And this is the result you get. Okay, so Mond-like and then dark matter. You can think about this as just both of them trying to get the rotation curve correct. So they both need to have approximately the constant enclosed mass within, 8 kpc. And so dark matter can be slightly lower down just because it has additional dark matter mass. Yeah? But that's why you get this negative correlation. And then you can look at the correlation between HR, scale radius, bulge mass, and these are data points. So data lives here. Let's just go into that plot a little bit more in detail. So data lives here. And you see that the Mond-like force is trying to make HR too small and M-bulge too large. Right? And the reason that I put two data points is because the data is kind of all over the place for the bulge mass. The bulge mass of the galaxy is measured very badly. And so that's just an unfortunate fact. And so this is kind of the range where data exists. And you look at this and you say, both of them are kind of doing okay, and that's true. But then if you look at the posterior for the interpolation function, so what I've plotted here is in red, forget about the gray, just look at the red. This is the value of the interpolation function locally. So this is just how much accelerations are being enhanced. Okay? And if you look at the posterior, you see that it's pushing towards 1, to unity. What's happening is that the Mond-like fit is trying to fit the data of the galaxy without using its Mondiness. It's trying to push as much baryons as it can to the center of the galaxy by reducing the scale radius and enhancing the bulge mass so that all of the heavy lifting is being done by baryons and it's trying to not use itself at all. That's what's basically going on. And so that's the picture. Every time one of these models tries to fit the galaxy, it tries to fit it by not using itself, basically, by using baryons. And the same thing happens when you use a specific interpolation function. So this is just a very generic statement. This is just to give you a feel of where the bulge mass measurements are. They're all over the place, and we used some fiducial value, which is conservative. And this is the result. So we've calculated the Bayes information criterion. It's a proxy for the Bayes evidence. So a number that's larger than one, as it grows larger, is more evidence for CDM. And so these are our results. Just look at these numbers over here. So if you use this Taylor expansion for the interpolation function, and you use a prior which requires that the interpolation function enhance just one or more, you get 4. If you require that it enhances even more, you require that the interpolation function have a minimum enhancement of 1.3, then this number grows to 7. So as you require that Mond uses its Mondiness more, it becomes less consistent. And that's true for any interpolation function you can use. So we just tested a couple to make sure. Let me show you quickly the results for superfluid. So here we're using the full rotation curve and all of the data because there's a prediction everywhere. And so what you see here in the top panels is the radial acceleration fit for dark matter on the left, where blue is the dark matter contribution, green is the baryonic contribution. You see that it fits nicely. And on the right is the same thing, but for superfluid, where green is the baryons, orange is the phonon contribution, so this interpolation function, and the dark matter contribution is totally negligible, and you see that it also fits nicely. And then this is the vertical acceleration result. And so you see that the dark matter model predicts less vertical acceleration than the superfluid model. Not by a lot, but again, this is for the best fit. And this turns out to already be quite inconsistent.
Is there no baryonic contribution on the right-hand plot? What does that mean?
No, there is. There's no dark matter contribution. It's here. It's actually here. It's just tiny.
What do you mean by phonons?
Phonons, I mean this emergent force, this phonon-mediated. Yeah. Right, so some corner plots. So left is CDM, right is superfluid. Don't look at everything here. Just look at the things in green. So this is just kind of consistency checks. We were able to recover the right dark matter density locally, so 0.36 GV per centimeter cubed, and that's consistent with other measurements. And we were able, for the superfluid model, to recover the right acceleration scale, 1.15 times 10 to the minus 10 meters per second squared. So this is just kind of consistency that we're doing things OK. And then this is really where you see the tension. So I've plotted you the corner plot for stellar scale radius, stellar scale height, surface density in stars, and surface density in gas. And the blue is the dark matter, red is superfluid. You see that the blue really sits on the data and red doesn't. And if you try and ask what's going on here, superfluid is trying to push as much mass as it can to the center of the galaxy and not use itself. That's basically what it's doing. And that turns out to be inconsistent. And the Bayes factor is 32, so it's like very decisive evidence for CDM. We did a number of checks. We redid the analysis using only one of the monoabundance populations and not all three, and we did all iterations of that. We changed the priors. We artificially enhanced all the error bars by a factor of 2. Nothing changed the results. Everything stays qualitatively the same. This is the summary of the result. As you make things, as you use more data and have a model that tests more region, you get stronger evidence. So when you're using only local accelerations and a Taylor interpolation function, you get positive evidence for CDM. When you use a specific interpolation function, but local measurements, you get strong evidence for CDM. And when you use all data and something like superfluid, it's very decisive. So the conclusions are that, the standard law is that Mond-like forces work on galactic scales. we find that not to really be true. Our results establish a new criterion for any model that attempts to reproduce the MDAR, and superfluid is a representative example, but it turns out that this whole class of theories doesn't really do the job. So let me leave you with two beers, which kind of tell the story that looks like this is good, and I think this is a Canadian beer, actually, right? Sorry about that.
Yes, good day.
Right, so thank you very much.
Two things. I just want to emphasize what I said earlier. My modified code, I call it MOG, not MOD, should fit that. It's an obvious result. The other thing about this whole all this business is that you have to fit all the cosmological data. You can't just fit galaxies. An overwhelming amount of data from cosmology. And I'm still working at it.
Sure, I agree. I mean, you need to have a model that fits everything. Yeah, and I think your model, you know, would do a good job with this test.
One does not work for cosmology.
True.
How useful would streams be for these real tests as well?
Yeah, we thought about that. I mean, with the stream, people have kind of, you know, measured how oblate the galaxy is.
That's right.
And that's a similar kind of test. And yeah, you could probably do something very similar with streams. If you imagine that the stream is just the path of a particle, and so you're measuring, you know, how oblate or prolate your galaxy profile looks like.
Well, to fit these like stream tracks, you have to know something about both like the radial acceleration but also like the vertical.
Yeah, I agree. You're probably right. I don't know if it's more sensitive or less sensitive to this, but it probably can be done. Yeah.
One other question. Justin Khoury's not here. So you presumably had some reaction from Justin.
We sent this to Justin before we published.
What
and he
say?
I mean he didn't have any big remarks. He well, you know, he thought that our analysis was good.
So he agrees.
I mean, there might be caveats. What we did here is, for example, you know, it's important to say that the superfluid has to be static in our analysis. It might not be static. I mean, there are a number of caveats, but yeah, he agrees with our analysis.
Will the data quality ever be good enough to do this with Andromeda, for example?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. That would be nice.
So, returning to this question whether this coupling variance is somehow emergent or fundamental, as to the fundamental at some level, right?
Sure.
Is, you know, like the it's the interiors of the stars gravitate that is have the most mass and so on, right? So this coupling is not what he played before, like with chameleon, right? It has to couple to matter. 100%, and then the only thing that what can happen is its propagator of that can be modified by the superfluid on the way, right?
Right.
So therefore, there must be meaning. I don't know what if you can get an enhancement out of that propagation, right? But there must be a meaningful just physics test for that whole. Earth has to be, right?
But the claim is that the superfluid is not in a superfluid state close to Earth.
Well, you would...
So it might not be...
1/r is created by this new fluid.
But it might not be 1/r there. You might have a coupling. I don't think it has to be 1/r on Earth. That's the point. Between two test particles that I hold in the lab, it
yes.
doesn't have to be 1/r...
This phi.
Correct, but the Lagrangian, you know, the thing that gave you the 1/r in the first place comes from the kinetic part of the Lagrangian.
Yes.
And that can be modified on Earth because you're no longer in the superfluid phase. You're no longer in the phase where phonons are your relevant degrees of freedom. And so it no longer has to be a 1/r, I think.
Does he have a UV completion for this?
He has a UV completion. He has two UV completions, one that he claims works and one that doesn't. In principle, it's coming from some phi to the 6 kind of theory. I mean, I can show you it. It's
but
messy, but
then back to the question of.
Let me tell you where the coupling comes from in his theory. What the words that he says is that it looks like the coupling is coming from coupling to the vortex, to the vortices of the superfluid. I don't want to claim that I understand exactly what that means, but this is the words that he has in his paper.
But that's not the fundamental coupling. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, how do you form structure in this expression? I don't even know what happens in CP because the energy density that you have in that pattern is very small.
Sure, I agree. I don't know the answer to that either.
You point out in your paper that the spherical halo, dark matter halo, force points towards the center. So you have a suppression for the vortex acceleration.
Right.
Like Z, Z, Z over R0.
Right.
This is sort of generic.
That's generic for any spherical profile. Yeah.
So you talked about keeping the spherical fluid static, but what about the area of stars themselves? So if there is some sort of like a wobble to the stellar disk,
well, that, yeah, that might, sure, that might be a caveat. I agree. I think that's similar to Mina's question. Yeah, that might be a problem. I don't know.
Because one thing I noticed was it's not statistically significant, I imagine, because it was just a slight deviation, but it did look like your cold dark matter predictions for the vertical acceleration were also a little bit off from the data.
So it actually turns out that if you use a slightly prolate profile, an egg shape for the dark matter, that actually fits the data better. And that actually is like kind of anti-mond, right? It does it enhances radial accelerations even more than it does vertical. And that gives you a better fit. But I mean, within error bars, it's all the same.
There must be a theorem that this thing goes back to one over our Newtonian potential if we take the two masses like that. Otherwise, it probably would be a decoupling of this five or interiors of big objects and so on.
Yeah.
It's when you know, forget about superfluid. It's some sort of a fundamental scale coupled to bearings, right? If not, then it's modified by the environment. That's no good. Okay, so.
Sorry, but Maxime, are you saying that even without that kinetic term in the Lagrangian, you're still worried?
Yeah, of course there will be.
But it might have a cutoff or something. I mean,
if I bring the two masses together like that, right? Forget the kiloparsecs like that. Is there a new Newtonian force or not between the two?
I think there must be, but it might be just tiny.
You know, astonished if there is not none, right? I mean, how is it possible? This thing couples to, I mean, like what I'm saying is that short distances, these excitations have a normal kinetic term, right? That's
sure.
Not modified by any superfluid.
I don't know. We're getting frustrated because in reality it's not a real field, and it's like a sleazy thing that escapes and defines things in a funny way. I don't know. I mean, it's unfair to you. I don't know. Look, I mean, the theory is, honestly, I don't know what this tells me. The theory is not well defined. It's not clear what you will be excluding.
I mean, I agree with this point. I don't have any complaint about what you're saying. What you're saying is correct. The theory is not well defined, I think.
But the motivation for this theory was to explain this bond-like behavior, and your point, I think, is that
anything that does that, exactly.
Anything that, no, if you say that mond relations do not apply, that's a general thing.
Sure. I mean, it's just an example theory, and maybe you don't like it, so, yeah.
But
yes.
But do people that aspire to mond try to whistle their way out of it, this one as well? Because there's been many times when
it has been killed. We sent our papers to Stacey McGaw and to Morty Milgram. Mm-hmm. Stacey had tried in the past to do the same kind of thing, but before Gaia data was out, and he had not managed. So he kind of knew that this was probably true. but he, you know, the data was not good enough to say anything definitive, but he was not surprised. And so he, I think, kind of agrees. Milgram wiggled his way out. And the way to do that was, I mean, you can have, there's something called the external field effect in MOND. It's some nonlinear effect that exists because of the nonlinear Poisson equation. And if you have a different interpolation function which governs your external field effect than does the rotation curve, then you can get out of this.
So what does that mean?
I mean, we didn't test that. We didn't test that, so it's possible.
So what is?
Yeah, you'd have two acceleration scales in your theory.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you have to. So the function has two parameters that you can fit in there, basically, the functions that you showed.
I don't know how to write down the model that he's imagining,
yeah.
But if you write down a model that has two scales, you might be able to get out of this, and we did not test that.
This is contrived.
Yeah.
So you're testing, you know, regions where MOND is supposed to be MOND-like, right?
Sure, but you might have it slightly more. I mean, we did a very, you know, our MOND theory was a single interpolation function. You could imagine that there are two functions that control different scales for some reason. I don't know how to write it down, but this was his reply. So I don't know if there's a model you can write down that does it. I mean, MOND is not a model either, right? It's just it's a phenomenological thing. You might be able to get out of this. Yeah.
Yes, we can. Thank the speaker for this good and nice analysis and nice talk.
Thank you.